Hello, this is David Perlman here for Conversations at the Whole Note, and my guest is Alison Mackay, who you will see anchoring tafel music from either behind the violone or the contrabass or the double bass. I'm not sure.
Either or. Yeah, skulking in the background.
Providing the steady beats to a lot of it. Before we go anywhere with this interview, I am going to officially return to you a book that I borrowed from you and David Follis at the time of your Paris Confidential that you did for Toronto Consort.
Yes, yes.
Which was November 2014.
Yes.
And which was an example that isn't a tafel music example, but certainly another example of some aspect of what you seem increasingly to love to do in terms of a certain kind of curation that cuts across the different disciplines, whether it's literature and music or literature and visuals and the rest of it. Because I remember this was a lovely thing, the way it immersed one into
16th century Paris
through the eyes of a Scotsman?
Yes, a Scottish philosopher named George Buchanan.
That's right.
Who was a very, very famous humanist in his time and not someone who's well known at all today, mostly because almost all of his writings were in Latin. But he was a famous poet, and they say he was the second most important humanist to Erasmus in Europe in his time. Yeah. But very little is known about him.
So I borrowed that because part of that show had to do with the bringing of Iroquois people to Paris, and that was chronicled from the Cartier, I remember.
Yes, and Ramsay Cook, who wrote the introduction to this book, was a great advisor on that project. I'm always very lucky to have a kind of deep bank of generous scholars that's been a very interesting aspect of these projects, and I think in a way they're a product of the internet age, because before you could get online, it would take a long time. I mean, I do spend many, many hours and days and weeks in Robarts Library in the university, but it takes a long time to establish who this sort of international experts on a certain topic are. And in the old days, you might figure out who that person was and take their books out of the library and read them. And then if you wanted to contact them, you might write them a letter by snail mail or try to phone them if they spoke English. But now you can identify that person, write them an email, because you can find often their academic email and the university website, write to them, and sometimes get an answer back the next day. It's really breathtaking. And one of the big learning curves about the whole thing for me has been to realize the excitement and generosity of some of these scholars in a lot of different fields that we've had contact with. In the case of the Galileo Project, we've gotten to know a number of astronomers in various fields, both in Canada and in Australia and New Zealand. When we did the program in Australia, we rewrote a section of the program to be about Aboriginal astronomy in Australia, and which has a very, very important and ancient tradition. And there's one astronomer named Ray Norris. I got in touch with him because of astronomers here, but people who see their life work presented to a wider public, and sometimes because tafel music or the Toronto Consort travel quite a bit, even an international public, to people who don't normally perhaps have contact with those kind of scientists, they can find it very moving. Yeah. A real high point was going to Penn State, I guess last year, the year before.
This is with which project?
This was with our Galileo project.
Still
with tafel music.
Let's just Take us back a little bit. Galileo was what year that it first happened?
So the Galileo project was in 2009 because it was part of the International Year of Astronomy.
Right.
Because in 1609, that was the first time that Galileo first turned a telescope on the night sky, and there were international celebrations of that event. And we were actually approached by the committee that was planning the Canadian events surrounding the International Year of Astronomy to think of curating a project that would somehow link music and art.
So what you're saying is that for many of the people whose disciplines are a scientific discipline, there's a kind of the celebration of the art of their science is not a gift that gets given to them very often.
Well, it's a very touching aspect of the relationships that we form, and a lot of it is about friendship. In the case of some of the world musicians who have been involved in our projects, someone like Wen Zhao, the amazing pipa player who was in our Four Seasons project.
And she's also in consorts, lute.
Marco Polo and lute.
The pipa oud project.
Yes. And several people like her have become part of our kind of family circle, a musical family circle. And we went to Penn State fairly recently with the Galileo project, and it turned out just by coincidence that the man who had been the head of the Hubble Imaging Bank, he was a retired emeritus professor who had come to Penn State, but he was happened to be in the audience and saw a number of images that he had created in the show with this, you know, beautiful music by Vivaldi or by Bach, and you know, it was
really
a very special thing for him, and he,
because our modern dissociations of the different muses into these separate silos is not something that's
always
been like that.
Yes, that's a very interesting thing to say, because of course in the time of Galileo, he came from a very musical family. His father, Vincenzo Galilei, was famous as a music theorist, but also as one of the first experimental scientists. Mm-hmm. And those lines were much more blurred than they are today. And there are a lot of scientists who are amateur musicians and interested in music. And seeing things come together can be exciting for all of us.
So you're talking about the reaching out and the finding of the experts, but before that, or I don't want to try and make it all linear, but somewhere there's an aha moment that tells you who the experts are that you're going to go and look for. The concept of why you do what you do. I mean, I go back in my own memory to the Four Seasons, which took the year of Vivaldi's composition of that and said, well, what's happening in this whole world that is musically
at that time
contemporaneous? And it's such an interesting way of living in a whole world where people sometimes see early music as being very narrowly, you know, Europe is the center of the earth that is the center of the universe, you know, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And that's always fascinated me about how these ways of cutting across strata of geography and time or seem to be something that you're so good at.
Well, I don't know about that, but the seed of these projects is always in the music. These events and performances are always concerts, and there's always a concert's worth of music in them, and it's very much about celebrating having a chance to perform some of the very best music in our repertoire. I hate having to include anything that is only there because it matches the subject.
Yeah.
I love to include very profound or really wonderful music, but give the best of our repertoire, but giving us a chance just from time to time to see it in a wider historical and cultural context. Mm-hmm. It shines a new light on the music. So it's not that I think that audiences their attention spans are shorter, yeah, or anything like that, that they need visuals or that they need bells and whistles. Mm. I still very much believe in purely musical concerts. But partly for the musicians to retain the excitement, something like the Four Seasons is something that our audience likes to hear pretty regularly. It's a very beloved piece. It's become a little bit cliched because we hear it so much in elevators and things like that. But our audience loves to hear it. We love to play it. It's such a showpiece for our violins. But it's very wonderful to bring some new dimension to it, to bring a new kind of excitement for us. Sometimes I tell the illustration of pieces in the Galileo Project or House of Dreams. Both David and I have been interested over the years in the stories from Ovid's Metamorphoses.
Yeah. And last time you were on the cover of the Whole Note, you were preparing for
the Metamorphoses.
Metamorphoses, having just done Mozart's Grand Partita. There you go, I'll put you in a moment in time.
Wow. And a lot of the repertoire that we play contains dance suites, overtures and dance suites from operas by Lully, for instance. Mm-hmm. And many opera composers in the 17th and 18th century were inspired by the stories from Ovid. They're rather brief stories, a lot of them. At the center of them lies a moment of incredible dramatic power where a person gets transformed into a flower or an animal, partly to explain a natural phenomenon like the name of a certain river, but also partly to examine the psychological truth of human behavior. And Ovid was an incredible interpreter of that. And all of these things appeal to opera composers. So there are many, many stories that lie at the heart of our core repertoire.
Right.
But so, for instance, for many years, we've played a suite from Marin Marais's opera Alcyone. Mm-hmm. Absolutely gorgeous music. We'll play an overture, we'll play a number of dances, and then we'll play a chaconne, and that makes a lovely concert piece. Well, when you put that same music in the context of the story that is informing each of those movements. Mm-hmm. And it's an amazing story about a devoted married couple who live in a peaceful kingdom, but then the kingdom comes under threat and the husband says, I have to go and consult the oracle of Apollo. And his wife is the daughter of the god of the winds, and she is justifiably afraid that he's going to be lost at sea. Mm-hmm. But he insists on going because duty calls, and he's immediately lost at sea and dies, is drowned. But then they're reunited and they're both transformed into birds.
Okay.
So when you put this music into that story, it makes it incredibly profound for the performers and for the audience. So not only does that add a cultural and historical dimension to the music, but it also adds a new layer of emotional context to the music. And ever after that, sometimes we now perform that music not with the story, but for the musicians, it informs our performance.
Yeah, I get it.
It heightens our performance.
Yeah.
Somehow I think the emotion of the way we communicate with each other, especially when we're playing from memory the way we do in these projects, that somehow that communicates a new excitement and emotion to the audience. And that, I think, of all the things that have perhaps had an influence on our performing life at Tafel Music, that's one of them. The grounding, the heightening, the enriching of context. Context is everything. It's so much. And there isn't any way that you can actually replicate the experience of being an audience member in a courtly setting or in a domestic setting in the 17th and 18th century, but you can do a little bit.
You can provide part of the elusive context that the composer at the time could
you
have
can
taken
enter
for
that
granted.
World. Yes, yeah. And you can
and
enter
you
that
can't
world
today anymore.
A little bit. And it's certainly true that something like the stories in Ovid to people who were readers, or those stories were as familiar to people as were the stories in the Bible. So if they heard music that was based on these stories, they would be entering that experience with a whole dimension that we're missing now. Yeah. And so this kind of storytelling, and those stories by Ovid are in very formal Latin, and they have been rendered by wonderful poets, English modern poets, in verse, you know, that it's scanned. But it ends up, and those are incredible pieces of art, but they end up being a little bit inaccessible and a little bit formal. And so I kind of like to tell the stories as if they're bedtime stories, so that people know them the way they might know, I don't know, fairy tales or stories from the Bible. Yeah.
So you mentioned House of Dreams. We're wending our way slowly towards Zimmerman's Coffee House, but House of Dreams, that was your most recent before this one?
No, the second most recent. Last year we did a project about Bach in Leipzig, and that was very much about that German coffee house tradition and the performance of secular music in German coffee houses. The project before that was bringing together visual art and music. It was a journey to five houses in five European cities: London, Venice, Delft, Leipzig, and Paris, where there were houses that are known to have had very important private collections of paintings. Mm-hmm. And in the rooms that the paintings were hanging, it's known that there were performances of music, often by the most important composers in those cities. And all of the five buildings still exist today in various incarnations. Two of them are small museums. One of them is a palazzo on the down at heel palazzo on the Grand Canal in Venice, which is now used as a venue in the Venice Biennale. It's owned by a foundation in Venice. One is a pancake restaurant in Delft, and on the main square of Delft, which has changed very, very little since the 17th century. And there was a bookbinder who lived in this house at the end of the 17th century, who was a very poor man. He was married to a young woman who tragically died after they'd been married for a year or two. And it's known from the municipal records that he had to borrow the money for her funeral, to buy a suit for her funeral. And he died a few years later, and it's known from his estate inventory that in his little tiny house, which is this little tiny pancake restaurant now, were hanging 23 of the 36 known Vermeers. So if you can imagine, on these walls, it was like wallpaper. And I'm talking about the most famous Vermeers, the woman measuring, you know, in balances, the little house, the girl with the pearl earring. And it's known from that estate inventory where the paintings were hanging. Some of them were in the front room, some of them were in the basement, some of them were in the kitchen. And it was a kind of accident of inheritance. It's because the young wife of this man, her parents had been patrons of Vermeer, and she had inherited those paintings from him. And the pancake restaurant today is very proud of the fact that Bill Clinton went to eat pancakes there. And they have a letter on the wall that's framed from Bill Clinton, which we had to remove. We asked to be able to remove from the wall because we went to do a photography session there. Mm-hmm. So because the houses all still exist, we were able at Tafel Musik to, over the course of about a year, form relationships with the present administrations of those five houses. One is the Bach Museum in Leipzig, which was the home of Bach's best friend. They were next door neighbors to Bach, and godparents to several of the Bach children. And they had a very, very famous art collection. And the Bach family performed in one of the rooms of the houses. And so we were able to forge these relationships with the present owners of the buildings to go and take photographs of the rooms where the paintings were, all of the paintings that were originally in the houses are now in museums, but because you can obtain incredibly wonderful high digital, high resolution images, we got permission from museums to use those images and then digitally put the paintings back in the rooms and then put the music live back in the rooms, which is what we were doing. And so a guest in the house would have the audience being invited into the concert. It would be a little bit like a guest in the house experiencing a Rembrandt and Handel directing a rehearsal of his music at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And that would have been, that's also a memorized piece for the orchestra.
Yes, we're now working on our fourth memorized project. It's a huge, huge undertaking for the orchestra, and I cannot tell you how incredibly grateful I am at the number of hours of unpaid work that go into that. I happen to know that at every intermission and before every performance of the opera that the orchestra is now, they're the pit band for Lucio Silla at Opera Italia right now, and I know that they're spending every spare moment having what we call play dates, where you just get together with whoever is there. Sometimes it's two people. You'll have a bassoon and a second viola or whatever, just running through all the parts together. And anytime anyone has an opportunity, two or three people will begin, and then everyone else will come running, and their hearts are in it so deeply. It's amazing.
It's a fascinating idea, because the assembled piece becomes, in a way, a collective memory, because as the music itself moves from instrument to instrument, there are things where people are leading and people are following. I would imagine that the ensemble memory is almost a thing in and of itself that's different from any individual's memory of the
Absolutely, on every level. It's been socially very transforming, as you can imagine. We all are on a tightrope together, and we rely on each other. The music is so complex. I can't compare us to jazz musicians. I mean, the brilliance of that, or traditional musicians, it's amazing. But it is a little bit different to memorize these very complex inner parts of Bach pieces. It's a huge undertaking. And of course, solo people playing concertos with orchestras do it all the time. But this is, at the same time, its own special challenge. Yeah. And it's interesting, when we lost our beloved viola player of many years, Ellie Weiner, who moved to Seattle, he had been in these projects for many years. And then we got our new wonderful violist from Italy, Stefano Marcocchi. And suddenly, because we had a new project, the Bach Circle of Creation project, which is about Bach's material world and his instrument makers and his people, how you made his gut strings and the people who made his paper. That was a new project, but the orchestra was also touring the Galileo project and the House of Dreams. So there were three memorized projects in one season, which was Stefano's first season. Wow. And we thought, oh my goodness, what an incredible undertaking. And he just set to work, slaved on it, and I don't think he ever played one wrong note at any rehearsal. So just the dedication to do that is extraordinary. I think that when you memorize something, of course it frees you up physically. I think the audience sees a very different musician holding a violin. You can turn to each other. You present a more complete physicality to the audience, I think, because you're not tied to a music stand. It also means that if there's a place in the music where two oboes and bassoons suddenly where they're suddenly featured, you can slightly change the figuration to visually feature that, and it underlines what's happening musically. And we work, as you know, with Marshall Pankowski as our, and he, in a very light-handed way, when he first came on the project, of course, we wondered what it would be like, because what he does with his singers in Opera Italia and his dancers is so very, very elaborate and detailed. And he's absolutely inspiring with us, but very relaxed. He said at the first rehearsal, "I've been watching you people for years. I watch you when you're warming up, when you think no one is looking, and you're just standing doing your thing, and you have a natural grace, and that's what I want you to keep. I don't want you to think about doing anything artificial. So what he's done is to make some beautiful patterns that he and I work very closely to underline how mm-hmm. that will work from piece to piece, and to make a beautiful visual effect and to inspire confidence. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can instantly tell a musician from an actor or a dancer because we have such terrible posture and we don't know how to hold our bodies. But it's not even that he talks about that. It's that he says, if you're moving from A to B, just walk. Don't sneak. Don't try to not be there. Just walk confidently. And somehow everybody is transformed by that. And of course, the more you do these projects, I think that we've done the Galileo project now around the world around 75 times. And somebody just counted up the House of Dreams and it's nearing 40. So the project, they continue to grow and develop, and they continue to musically grow. Mm-hmm. You have to have very strong music in the concerts for that to happen, because can become kind of stale.
It's got to have a perpetual potential for discovery within the music itself.
Yes, mm-hmm. And I think that you learn it. Another thing was, we had these very nervous discussions, all of us. It's not that I was confident that I'd be able to do it or that that it would all work. It was just kind of a big experiment when we started. And one thing Jean said was, well, how are we going to rehearse? Because normally when you rehearse, you say, okay, we're all going to start at bar 76, and then you look at your music and you begin together. So we had our first rehearsal with absolutely everybody of the Galileo project in Banff, because we workshopped it at the Banff Center. And that was never an issue. From the very first rehearsal, someone would just start playing and everybody would know where to start. Yeah. So that was an interesting thing. The other thing is that you practice in a different way. Usually when you practice, you pick out the hard bits that are technically challenging and you woodshed those and work them over and over again. But when you memorize, you have to practice the whole thing that way. Mm-hmm. And so it really, I think, lifts the technical aspect. And because you're communicating in a different way, it also lifts the ensemble playing.
And you don't all have the hard bits at the same time
in
your parts.
So you
have to go with the ensemble in that context.
Yeah, and I'm very much not a soloist myself. There wasn't really solo repertoire written for the double bass, and I'm not that kind of player anyway. But so I see one of my contributions to the orchestra was to put each single person in the orchestra in the limelight for a while. Yeah. So, trying to spread around the solo so that everybody in turn steps up to, into the light. And I think that also is a very healthy thing for the kind of karma of the orchestra, that people don't feel as if they're always in the back row.
We'd better get around to talking about the new one, or certain people will be... We feel that the exercise has been a wasted one. So the new one is also another story of intersections. But let me tell you a fun thing. On the 21st, which is the middle of your run, 21st I think is the Saturday, 21st of May, at Kerner Hall will be Zimmermann's Coffee House in Leipzig will be on stage in your show, right?
Yes, yes.
And on the same evening, in the Peter Hall of the Moravian College in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, Zimmermann's Coffee House will be taking place on the second last day of the Bethlehem Bach Festival.
Oh, how wonderful.
They do that every year.
Well,
the coffee house is a relatively new initiative there, but that particular Bach Festival has been going since 1905,
yes,
uninterrupted.
It's a very,
have you been there?
I don't think so, but it's a very august, well-known festival.
Yes. I'll be going again this year.
Oh, fantastic. But we must get in touch with them because it would be really fun to do some kind of...
They have four Canadian soloists out of six.
Oh, wonderful.
They have Daniel Taylor, Agnes Zygwicz, Ben Butterfield, and Daniel Lichty are the four out of the six. So what's interesting about that one is that Moravian College if you trace it back to its one-room schoolhouse days, goes back to 1745, which is only 20 years after the original Zimmerman's Coffee House. Mm-hmm, so it's just, to me, that was just such another
amazing
one of these funny synchronicities. So your project, as I understand it, takes Leipzig and it takes Damascus. And again, it's this, I won't call it a trademark, but it's recognizable of taking different places at the same moment in time and finding these extraordinary parallels. So
well,
tell me about it.
It's very interesting because these two cities, such a long distance apart and seemingly so very different, did have certain things in common. They were both entrepôt cities at the crossroads of ancient, often Roman roads, ancient trade routes or caravan routes. Leipzig, of course, is in central Germany, and it's a small city. It's not that it was a huge place, but it lay at the crossroads of the east-west road that went, or the route really, because it's often a series of roads, but that went from Santiago de Compostela right to Kiev and Moscow. And it's not that one person would start in Santiago de Compostela and probably travel to Moscow, but goods and ideas flowed gradually along that route. And then there was a north-south route that ran from Rome and from Venice up to the Baltic Sea. And those two roads crossed right in the middle of Leipzig. And because of that, the Holy Roman Empire, emperors declared it a kind of tax-free, a trade fair center with tax incentives and a protected place where you wouldn't be allowed to have trade fairs within a certain distance. So it meant that for centuries, traders from all over Europe and as far away as Siberia, London, and Constantinople converged in this little
crossroads.
Yes, of 30,000. I mean, it's about the size of the annex in Toronto. And so that's one thing. And the city of Damascus, which was a much more ancient city, I mean, some people think it's the oldest continually inhabited city in the world. It's certainly one of them. And it lay at the crossroads of the routes that went from the Mediterranean, from Tyre, Sidon, and through Syria to Baghdad, through Iran, and to the Far East,
the Silk Road.
And the north-south route that went from Yemen up through Mecca and Medina, Damascus, Aleppo, and up to Anatolia, and finally in Istanbul. And Damascus became the place where the travelers who were on the annual pilgrimage, the Hajj, to Mecca and Medina. This, of course, is the pilgrimage that was required once, or is required once in a lifetime of devout Muslims. They were provisioned for the very dangerous journey, that usually done by camel. I think it took 40 days or something like that, in Damascus. And then they would go down to Mecca. Perhaps they would travel as far as Yemen, but they would come back to Damascus with coffee, which was grown, the first known cultivation of coffee farmers was in Yemen. The plant, the Arabian coffee plant, was native
Arabica
to, was native, they think, to Ethiopia, but the first recorded cultivation of it was in Yemen. And they think this was associated with Sufi, in the 16th century or maybe, but it was Sufi worshippers who would gather twice a week in lodges. Most of these Sufi mystics were, you know, barbers and merchants. They had other, it wasn't like they were priests, but they would gather in Sufi lodges for nighttime devotions in which there was singing and dancing. And they used coffee as a stimulant to stay awake through the night. And that's how they think the first drinking of coffee took place. And then coffee gradually traveled up to Damascus. They think that the first commercial coffee house was actually in Damascus. Sometimes we talk about it being in Istanbul, but and then a coffee trader from Damascus opened the first coffeehouse in Istanbul, and then of course it gradually spread to Europe. But there grew up in Damascus also a tradition of trade fairs. Right. Caravans would come from Baghdad and from the Mediterranean and meet these travelers who were coming back from the pilgrimage, and they would sell jewels and silks and coffee. So the two cities had that in common.
So in both cases you've got an intersection of a trade axis and an axis of pilgrimage.
Yes, exactly.
Which is very interesting.
Very interesting, very yes. And the second thing is that both cities were very famous and important centers for scholarship and right. learning. Leipzig had one of the most, one of the oldest universities in Europe, and not one of the really early medieval universities like, you know, Oxford or Cambridge, but a very old university with a very famous library. And it was also a hugely important center for book publishing and book dissemination. There were huge book stalls at the trade fairs. And again, for the dissemination of poetry, of literature, of plays, and philosophy, and intellectual ferment of all kinds. And this is also true of Damascus. It was one of the great centers in the Islamic world for scientists, for theologians, for law experts, for poets, for travel writers. And one of the interesting, in a way, coincidences, although this is the thing that sort of set me on the path of pairing the cities, is that in the 18th century, there was a very important family library in the heart of in the heart of Damascus, and the name of the family was the Rafaya family, and they had what has turned out to be one of the most important private collections of most important collections of religious and non-religious manuscripts, many of which were copied by famous Damascene scribes in the 18th right. century, and this collection has, again, works of astronomy, medicine, science, poetry, philosophy. It just shows the breadth of Islamic scholarship. And this collection came to the University of Leipzig because the Prussian ambassador, this is a little bit later than Bach, but the Prussian ambassador to Damascus was in Damascus at the time that the head of the Rafaya Library decided they wanted to sell that collection. So it wasn't like the Elgin marbles that were sort of plundered. Mm-hmm. It was right. that it was an intentional sale because the Rafaya family wanted to buy some property. And this Prussian consul had been a student of a very famous Arabist scholar at Leipzig University as a student. And so he had a sentimental connection with the university, and he wanted to ensure, and so through the Prussian government, this sale was arranged. And I should say that these manuscripts joined a set of manuscripts from Damascus that were in the municipal library of Leipzig from the time of Bach. And it's an incredible coincidence that in the spring of 1723, in May of 1723, Bach appeared before the town council in Leipzig as part of his kind of audition process, and he was interviewed by them. And in that same spring of 1723, there was a young scholar who taught at the university and was kind of an archivist at the university, a German scholar, addressed the same town fathers of the town council in Arabic, asking, I mean, it must have been astonishing, but asking permission to, I suppose, have some funding to be the one to catalog this already existing body of manuscripts from Syria and from Damascus. So already from the time of Bach, Leipzig was a center for Arabic, a kind of center for the study of Arabic. This was partly because, this is a real tangent, stop me if I shouldn't go into all of this, but in the very nearby city of Halle, where Handel was from, there was a famous foundation. It just reminds me of your Moravian schoolhouse. Mm-hmm. It was started by a pietist theologian called Franke, and he started a foundation. It was sort of a social experiment where he wanted to have a series of schools, small classrooms for boys for sons of the aristocrats and noble people of Halle, and the daughters and sons of every member of every class in Halle. So there were classes for children of artisans, for orphans. It became known for a while as the Halle Orphanage. Mm-hmm. And there was a very, very high standard of teaching at this. And for a while, there was a scholar named Solomon Negri, who was a scholar from Damascus. He was a Syrian. And he was involved in one of the first translations of the Quran into English. He went on to London to be involved in that. And one of the first translations of the New Testament into Arabic. And he taught a lot of these young people in the orphanage at Halle, and a number of them went to Leipzig, to university, and Leipzig became interested in Arabic studies. So that's one thing that has made a kind of coincidental. And I should say that this area of Germany has become a bit of a living ark for Syrian culture, thank goodness, because if that library were now in Damascus, it would probably be gone. And so that's one very kind of powerful actual link between them.
As is this moment in time to be reminding people that this is not a one-way street in terms of cultural traffic.
I know. And
or human traffic.
Yes. And the third sort of piece of the puzzle is that both cities in the first part of the 18th century had a very, very lively coffee house culture in which people sat and drank coffee and were entertained by the best musicians in the city. So Bach, of course, and Telemann in different periods were directors of coffee house ensembles with incredible music, secular music being performed over coffee. And also in Damascus, there were famous musicians, often Jewish and Christian and Muslim, who would play sometimes together, who would entertain the patrons. Both of these coffee house cultures were very much men's worlds, although in both cases often women were owners of the establishments and often performers in them. There were often female singers and musicians who performed in Damascus, and from time to time women did go, but it was a bit like the 50s in Toronto, where if you went to Dundas Street, you know, the coffee shops would be very male. People would be playing, drinking espresso and playing billiards so there's also that parallel. So we're going to make a magical coffee house.
And who are the musicians? Obviously, Tafel, your core ensemble, is there.
Yes. Yes, we're very excited to be welcoming three wonderful musicians who have formed kind of a new trio for the project called Trio Arabica. Okay. And that consists of the very well-known musician Miriam Toller, who was born in Egypt, grew up in Canada, but traveled to Syria and was trained by amazing musicians. She's highly schooled in the Syrian tradition of classical Arabic music. And she'll be joined by a wonderful oud player, Dimitri Petsalakis, and the percussionist Nagme Faramund, who is originally from Iran. She comes from a very august family of percussion, Persian percussion players, music. And so they're going to be performing as if in their coffee house. We'll be performing as if in our coffee house, and the whole thing will be...
And shall the twain meet?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, in strange and wonderful ways. There are a few opportunities in the course where we'll be playing together, and at the end of the concert we'll actually be playing together. And then I wanted just not to go back and forth, but also to look at places where the two cultures met. And so as a bit of parallel to the way musical styles traveled, we're tracing the progress of coffee from the Middle East up through Istanbul to Venice, to Paris, to London. And then there's an amazing story about the Ottoman ambassador to Louis the 15th, who brought something like 10,000 pounds of coffee beans around 1720 to Paris to sell while he was there. And one of the things he did, you know, there are always very detailed records of these ambassadorial visits. Mm. And one of the things he did was to go to an event organized by Louis XV's royal librarian, where they examined the differences between Arabic music and French music. And there was a discussion and probably a performance by musicians, because of course these ambassadors always brought musicians with them. Right. And so we're going to try to kind of recreate that in a bit of a way.
And in the middle of all of this, musicians working from memory.
Yes, yes.
And actually steeped in all this extra context. And
So
the same huge difference for how they experience it then translates to the audience.
Well, the concert is being animated verbally by Mariam herself, who will sometimes speak in mm-hmm. Arabic, and by the wonderful Toronto actor Alain Nashman. Okay. And he'll be weaving, very much like the other projects, he'll be weaving the music together, partly as a storyteller. His role, when I have my first meeting with actors, and we've worked with a number of really mm-hmm. wonderful actors over the years, I say sometimes you're a storyteller, sometimes you're a bit of a documentary narrator, as if you're narrating a kind of travelogue. Often you're heightening the emotional story of the whole thing, and very much the glue that somehow holds it all together.
So it's the weekend of the 18th to the 21st at Kerner, and then
at Kerner Hall. Yes.
Takes the other axis up to the Western for one.
Yes, I'm very excited because we're going to be workshopping the project at the amazing new facility at Queen's University, at the Isabel Bader Hall, where our beloved Tricia Baldwin has gone to be mm-hmm. the director of that facility. So not only do they have an exquisite hall with amazing acoustics, but they have an amazing rehearsal space. The rehearsal room is wonderful.
I've been in
Yes, and facilities for recording, for photographing.
I was told by the acoustician there that the volume of the rehearsal hall is identical to the volume of the hall itself.
Yes, they tried to make that identical. And you have this incredible view over Lake Ontario, and it's absolutely exquisite.
Absolutely.
So we'll be doing the premiere performance at Queen's and then bringing it to Kerner Hall. Then we'll be in North York at the Toronto Centre for the Arts. And then on the following Wednesday, we'll be performing it in Hamilton.
Fantastic. So, since this is all now about to be real, I'm sure you're already brewing on the next one.
Oh, I am thinking about that a little bit. I'd like to just also mention that I'm very excited because sort of for the first time we're bringing a scholar in residence from Dresden, especially for the project. We're bringing her together with the Aga Khan Museum. And I should say that the Aga Khan Museum in Toronto is a partner in this project. They're helping us to animate the lobby of the Kerner Hall with a feeling of entering a Damascus courtyard. So there are going to be banners and flowers, and we hope there's going to be some special coffee drinking. And Anka Sharas, who is one of the world experts on the restoration of 18th century Damascus interiors and these special, beautifully colored interior reception rooms, which often had music and coffee in them, is going to be coming to speak to the audience, to meet with students and scholars from U of T, and to also work in a curatorial capacity at the Aga Khan Museum, because they have Damascene coffee panels installed in their restaurant there. So there's some very interesting crossovers, even in our own city.
That's fantastic. And we'll talk again about the next one. I won't take it that far now. This is really, really interesting. And try and find a way to a place for some of the visuals as well, looking at all of these, and they obviously don't translate to this context, but we'll find a way of
thank you so much,
giving people access to that, except that the way to have access to it is to come to the show.
Oh, well, that would be great. We'd love to see everybody there.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, David. Really interesting. Very much. Thank you.
Thank you. You've been listening. We'll see you again. Bye-bye.